All right, it's 4 o'clock. My Methodist self says start on time, end on time, regardless of whether everybody who intends to be here is here, and regardless of whether everybody who is here intends to stay. As I was saying before, we might want to have an escape route just in case folks thought they were in Ephesus or decided they wanted to grab one of the last root beer floats or whatever it is. This is the session on a session on spirituality and technology. I'm Colleen, and I am a United Methodist. Thank you for letting me be here among you. And just a few words of introduction, so you can make the choice about whether you want to get into it, and then we'll say a prayer and get into our session proper. I've said this every day as I've started, so please forgive me if you've heard it before. I come to this work through three sources. The first of which is that my father is addicted to personal electronic technology. He really is. The second of which is I want my sons not to be addicted to personal electronic technology. And the third is that even though I didn't do my dissertation or graduate work on this subject, as soon as I started teaching at California Lutheran University, I was convinced that whatever else I was going to teach, in every single class, I was going to have to build in something about technology. How to use it, how to turn it off, how to engage the spirit, whether or not my students were Christians. So I find it really productive and helpful to think about being at least bicultural, and depending on how you move through your life, it might be tri or quad or however many, but at least one of them is our Christian identity. A Christian identity that says Christ is for all peoples, all times, all places, all languages. It's an identity that transcends any time and place. And yet, it must be made real in time and place and language. And we are always moving in the broad stream of our world as well. So if we can think of ourselves as at least bicultural, then those parts of ourselves can talk to each other and can critique and construct each other. So that's a bias that I have. I have another bias I should tell you about, and that is that I think our activities are in daily life shape the way we understand God. Absolutely, the way we spend our time, the way we move our bodies, the way we direct our attention, shape how we view God, how we see the world, and how we interact with others. So occasionally, we have to do something like this where we raise what's usually unconscious about our daily life up to the level of consciousness. In some cases go, whoa, and in other cases go, aha, right? And then transform our daily lives perhaps bit by bit so that we're living in the world and we're also claiming our Christian identity. So those are my biases. I don't take it personally if you decide you don't want to be here. I hope that the conversation in this time will be rich, as well as other times that we might have. I do encourage you to make comments or ask questions at any time. I believe the Spirit's moving through all of us all of the time, and it could be that what you have to say is exactly what the Holy Spirit wants this crowd to hear. So please, if you've got a comment or a question, offer it. The Spirit might be speaking through you. So with that said, let's pray. God, for this day, we give you thanks for the feeling of freedom among your people. We give you thanks for the feeling of freedom in your creation. We give you thanks. Turn our attention to you, O God, that we might be vessels of your grace in the world that we love. In your name and for your glory, amen. 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 I'm blessed. All right, we're going to go straight in and start off with the addiction part. All right? I may have a convincing job here to do. I may not. But I'm serious when I say that I think addiction is possible in terms of our personal electronic technology. And so what I have is a two-sided handout. One of them's from 2011. The other one's from 410 or 415 or so, as in like the 5th century, right? So these are our anchors for today, and we're going to see how they're related. This will be about one per three or four people. So we need to, we can. Thank you. And we're going to pass them out just to hear some of these descriptions of addiction. And as we pass them out, I'll give you a little bit more context. So there was a study done by some folks in Maryland, students, university students from 10 different countries, asking them to abstain from electronic technology for 24 hours. And this is a summary of their findings. So we're going to start with their descriptions of addiction, and then as you feel led and as it is appropriate to you, chime in with whether you've felt this or seen this, and chime in with other descriptions of addiction that you have too. All right, so this is a good opportunity to hear other people's voices other than mine. So Nancy, would you read the first bold, students' addiction to media on the reflection side. Yep.
What happens when 1,000 students in colleges across...
Sorry, Nancy, just start with the first piece point there.
Students'
addiction.
Addiction to media may not be clinically diagnosed. Students' addiction to media may not be clinically diagnosed, but the cravings are real. Students repeatedly use the term addiction to speak about their dependence on media, the study reported. Media is my drug. Without it, I was lost, said one student from the UK.
Thank you. Okay, so they're using addiction in inverted commas here, but then they use the word craving, and that is very much a part of addiction. So when you hear the word addiction, what do you usually? What are your associations?
Drugs,
alcohol,
gambling,
food, pornography. Augustine from the 5th century, he was a sex addict, right? So when we talk about drugs or alcohol or gambling addictions, what's the usual course of treatment or the preferred course of treatment in the United States?
Therapy.
Therapy leading to what kind of behavior?
Abstinence,
right? So technology is more like food in that in our culture, in our day and age, it is going to be nearly impossible to abstain totally, right? Which makes it an even more insidious form of addiction. Insidious meaning lying in wait, right? To surprise you, okay? And an addict itself means you're signed over already, right? You're bound over already in advance so that you're not making decisions anymore about what you want to do. So here is where I have to show my Lutheran credentials. Because the freedom of a Christian has a definition of freedom from Martin Luther that's been informing me in my faith practice and my study for a very long time. And his definition of freedom can really help us, and it's why I chose this topic for this day on the 4th of July. So technology's great promise is to make you free, right? If you are wireless, you don't have to be tethered to a cord. Right? You can walk around. Somebody brought this up yesterday, right? You can do your work outside. You can do it from home. You can do it remotely, right? You can feel free. And yet, if we're going to talk about addiction, it is very much a state of unfreedom or non-freedom because you're signed over in advance to something you haven't chosen to do, right? You're given over in advance already. So are there any people whose Lutheran credentials are like mine in that you can rattle off the definition of Christian freedom from memory?
A Christian is perfectly free, Lord of all, and perfectly servant to all.
Yes.
So perfectly free, Lord of all, perfect servant of all.
Awesome. So a Christian is perfectly free, Lord of all. He uses that language because he's living in fiefdom, so that language makes sense. Perfectly free, Lord of all, subject to none. Right? You do what you want. Right? Not signed over to anybody. And, paradox tension, a Christian is perfectly dutiful servant, subject to all. Right? So, when we're going to understand freedom, we have to look at a freedom that's going to be bound in its freedom as well. So, the question isn't, trying to be unmoored from anything, or abstaining from anything, but to what do we want to be bound? What's our primary connection? So it helps, I think, to start in our culture and to start by trying to recognize some behaviors, some people that might be you or might be people you know and love. Okay, so just as addiction is real, this is the part about not being able to abstain, the second peace point. And let's see, Susan, would you read the second peace point, please? Yes, that's Susan.
Being tethered to digital technology 24/7 is not just a habit, but is essential to the way students manage friendships and social lives.
Keep going.
How they use media shapes how others think of them and how they think about themselves, the report said. Increasingly, no young person who wants a social life can afford not to be active on Facebook, and being active on the site means living one's life on the site, the report remarked.
Thank you. Okay, so this technology, especially social media, is essential to the lives of these students. For how many people in this room is social media essential to your presence in your communities? Yeah?
Yeah. Like, if you, this is an example that's brought up. People don't send out invites anymore to parties, like physical invites, you know? So if you want to be invited, like, I have friends that don't use Facebook, they're against it, and they get left out of, like, bigger parties. They're not left out on a grander scale, but, like, they don't get the invite because it's only through Facebook. Mm-hmm. If you don't have Facebook, how are you going to find out about stuff?
How are you going to find out?
Mm-hmm. I'm a coach, and we use Facebook to communicate to our, I don't know how coaches did it 20 years ago. We use it to communicate when there's rain outs and all of that, and mm-hmm. so I've had a couple parents who don't, have cell phones or don't have the internet and don't have Facebook. They don't want their kids to have them, and I understand that. But I always had to make a couple phone calls to those parents because they weren't keen or they missed out on that information. So that piece of it, I'm very connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. So parties and coaching.
Mm-hmm. I'm part of the Holden Village Communications team, and at this mm-hmm. very moment, one of my partners, Serena, is up on her computer uploading photos from today's 4th of July parade, and we have several thousand people on Facebook who are going to want to share with the parade that we all participated in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's another thing. Like, I wouldn't get many of the pictures that I wanted for Holden if my friends hadn't uploaded them to Facebook.
For sure, and at its best, this kind of technology connects us in ways that before were unimaginable, right? It extends our reach and makes possible communication with people we otherwise wouldn't be in communication with or with whom communication would be more difficult, right? So it's not all bad. There are life-giving elements to this technology, right?
In on South Park with the TV show, They did an episode on Facebook, and it's really hilarious because the persona or the profile of one of the characters becomes larger than him, and he's fighting for his life against this profile that basically tells him, I'm it, I'm the reality here, you are not. And at one point, there's this image where the computer, through the camera, sort of atomizes the child that's in front of the computer and absorbs it into the computer physically. So it's a really interesting episode.
Yeah. That's a fascinating commentary. Other thoughts on this piece on social media?
Well, for me, it's a way for me to stay in touch with my grandchildren because they're on it. I learned to text, and I went on Facebook because if I text them, they'll answer me. Or they'll text me, or they'll put stuff on Facebook so I can kind of see what's happening with their lives,
I'm so glad you said that piece about grandchildren, and in this other case about coaching, right? Because if we opt out, if we try to abstain from this kind of technology, we are really missing out on an opportunity to enculturate the gospel in our time, in our world, right? That's why we have to be bicultural, because Fortunately, we don't have any say on the gospel part. God's redeeming work through Christ has already been given to us, already been established. We have that. But God does need help in every age, in every time, inculturating that gospel in that time's language, in that time's technology, in that time's way, right? Tomorrow's session's more about spiritual practices, and one of the things we're going to do is explore how Christian communities have often been at the forefront of a new technology because they saw the potential for how to spread the gospel, including the book, right? And the scroll, you know, and various other kinds of things like that. So that it's not just a habit or not just gratuitous, right? It is essential somehow to the culture. But that's even more why we have to moderate ourselves or at least retain the self-reflection so that we can understand addiction. All right, we're going to skip the third piece point right now, but we need to go to the fourth one to really get to grips with why this matters and why we have to deal with it. Karen, you have a sheet, I think. Will you read that one, please?
For many students, going without media ripped back the curtain on a hidden loneliness. For some students, the problem went beyond that. Some recognized that online connections had been substituting for real friendships.
Thanks. All right. What about this one? Does this one ring true for anyone? Ripping back the curtain on a loneliness. Discovering that Facebook friendships are not the hearty, robust kind of friendships that you would hope for yourself or for your children or grandchildren or neighbors. And the thing is that how does it hide the loneliness? So let me just have you explore with the technologies you use. So with the technologies you use, either personal computer doing Facebook or your smartphones or your iPods, how might they hide loneliness? Constant stimulation. Yeah.
It uses up a lot of time.
Yeah, a lot of time.
A lot of time.
Yeah.
Emptiness at times, but it feels like it's going to be feeding. Sometimes it's very interesting. Sometimes it's...
Right. So we have through... Yeah. Constant stimulation and time.
Well, it's like a pseudo-relationship. I'm not talking to Sally. I'm sending a computer message and Sally's responding. It's not like I'm talking to you. It's like
right.
It bounces off a satellite and shows up here.
Or you can't be sure, maybe going back to the South Park image, right? When I'm communicating with Susie, are we using this medium to facilitate as best as we can to an in-person conversation? Or are we our avatars, right? Our avatars competing in this virtual space, you know, in which we're acting out some drama, which isn't really real to us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let me get to the time and the constant simulation issue, because that's how we connect to Augustine, our guy from the 5th century. And we're not going to go to him right away, but I want to flag these right now. So the constant simulation is related to the desire of the eye for something new, right? The constant craving. And I'm just going to tell you right now that Augustine said that the primary temptation was through the eyes. Now, he didn't have electrical power at all, right? So there's something deep in what it means to be human and a human in the world that relies on our eyes so that we can experience temptation through the eyes, right? So the temptation itself isn't new, but our personal electronic technologies have sped up and made really available, right? Increased the temptation perhaps for that constant stimulation. And Nicholas Carr, who wrote a book called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, and others, study the physiological changes in the brain that happen. And every time you click on something or you check a text, there's a release of dopamine. It's just like lab rats in those experiments who get dopamine when they go and get food, right? So if you are experiencing that, then you go and you check more often, even if you don't get the happy every time, right? Because maybe this time when you check, you'll get the happy, right? So you check and check and check, waiting for the happy, right? So constant stimulation. Now, Nancy mentioned time. And the time, how would you describe the time of personal electronic technology? Anybody want to try to describe your experience of time?
You lose the sense of time.
You lose time.
Yeah.
You lose it.
Well, the time suck.
Time suck, yep.
Time yeah. Computer. Yeah. Yeah. And in, yeah.
You get more impatient
mm-hmm.
and stuff goes slower. Actually, as technology gets better, you get really angry if something takes like 10 seconds rather than two.
Right.
The computer. And it's just like, wow. It's like it teaches impatience.
It does, yes. It does teach impatience, right? And the word patience itself means to endure or to suffer, right? So if we're impatient, we're unwilling to endure. Yeah, I used to sing a song to the sound of dial-up, you know, and now it's not there anymore. Like, the dial-up would start, and I would just sort of sing a song, try to make harmonies with it.
Yeah, on the other hand, one of the things it also does with time is it allows us to do things asynchronously that we couldn't do otherwise. You know, meetings and things that can happen,
yeah.
Collaboration, when you can't get everybody together at the same time in the same place,
mm-hmm.
but you can collaborate over a long period of time.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, we use that as campus pastors a lot. You know, there are questions that we're kind of thinking about. You send out notes. It's a network of conversation.
Right. So at its best, it can bring people together across time who otherwise wouldn't be together for really fruitful, wonderful conversations. My best friend just lived in Hamburg for 5 years by herself. You know, no spouse, no parents, no children. And she would not have survived without Skype and Facebook, right? So there are ways that we can be connected this way. And yet that time suck, even though it feels like this long, drawn-out time, it's a time that's now, 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 now. Now, right? Continually calling to us in that constant stimulation. So it's never a sort of presence in which we would try to say now, right? It's hard to capture the now. And this doesn't even try to capture the now. It's click again, click again, click again, now, 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 right? And so in commentaries on Augustine, Martin Heidegger talked about how this ends up being a stretched now. So we stand into the now, and that's all we have. We're robbed of any real sense of future or anticipation, and we're robbed of any real sense of value of past or what has come before us, and we're just caught up in the now, right? So the first time I was starting to read this and think about this about 10 years ago, I was trying to do it in really accessible language, and so I used a cultural phrase. Living in the now. Live in the now, right? May be hazardous to your health was how I started, right? And started trying to really address how our culture understands now and the desire for the new and the demand to keep up, right? Because you're going to miss something if you don't participate in it, right?
Can I say something?
Please, yeah.
I know a little bit about addiction because I have identified myself as an alcoholic. Like, I've been sober for 13 months. And so I've learned a lot about addiction in this time. And when you said robbed, like, an addict doesn't think of it as being robbed of the now, of the future, of the past. It's like, you want to avoid it.
Right.
So, like, that's why you want to numb that out and not accept it. So technology has provided that, you know, for people and for me. I was even just telling my friend Pam, like, I feel like I'm going through withdrawals, not from substances anymore, but from something. Like, I got in touch with that hidden loneliness the past 2 days, actually, even though I'm surrounded by people.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, definitely. You're in some deep stuff.
Hitting the cord.
Yeah.
Also in this book, The Shallows, and in Marshall McLuhan's long ago book, Understanding Media, he says that whatever technologies we come up with, in our world, and I said, and I'm not kidding, this is a technology, right? Anything that extends our reach into the world is a technology. But everything we come up with ends up numbing exactly the facility we were trying to amplify.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Paradox.
A paradox, yeah.
For sure.
So that if you talk about if we're talking about the eyes, the primary temptation of the stimulation of the eyes, you're coming across new things all the time, things that please, things that frighten, things that are horrific, things that are boring, and then your ability to take in a scene before you through your eyes is numbed. We call that desensitized, right? We've talked about that in terms of the media. If it bleeds, it leads. But now blood doesn't evoke the response that it used to. And we need more and more to satisfy our sense of horror, right? Or to feel like we've seen the news. So it ends up numbing precisely the sense it was trying to amplify, which is our ability to connect with something through our eyes. Right? Was there somebody trying to jump in? Yeah.
Sometimes that we want to experience it, I'm picking up on your now phrase.
Yeah.
I notice more and more, not just like in concerts, but sometimes also in the church, we want to experience the now through technology rather than a direct relationship that's right in front of us. Mm-hmm. And so you watch a concert through the technology.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what to do with that, because you see it in concerts up front, but you also see it in all sorts of events where there's something about experiencing the now through technology that's even better than putting the technology away and just taking it in directly. Mm-hmm. What's been your experience with that? Because there's something going on there which I think is really interesting.
Watching the Jumbotron instead of the person.
The game?
Yeah, right.
Or watching the concert through an iPhone rather than actually just watching the musician.
Well, there's some of that that is, I've tried to be as charitable as I can, that's a justice issue for people who otherwise wouldn't be able to see it or hear it. But there's another part of that that is a definition of the world and of reality in which what's electronic is more real than what is flesh.
Or superior.
Right? Or superior, right? Of superior quality. And that's, to my mind, largely because the connection is one-on-one, right? It's directed toward you, whereas a concert or a worship service is not directed toward one without some imagination. It is really for a group, for an all. So that the good parts of that, and this is a little bit what we were doing yesterday with I, God, yes, we want to receive God's love for us directly. We want to receive and be open to justifying grace. And yet, if we never see our neighbor, we're not fulfilling what God has asked us to do, and we're not experiencing God's love for the world, right?
But he's right here on Facebook. What do you mean?
Right there. I know. Just click and he comes on demand, right? Yeah.
With stimulation and time, the other facet here is that all the technological stimulation is also the absence of other kinds of stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
It's related to this comment. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about a new student I was working with a few years ago who was really struggling in adapting to campus life. And I got a phone call from her youth director to say, I'm emailing her 4 times a day. I don't know what more to do. And I said, well, stop that. You know, while we have all these things to help new students adapt, meet each other, acclimate, this student is waiting for the next email from her youth director.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if the absence of the enfleshed doesn't also make it less real to us or less accessible or
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
It's a haunting absence, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then that applies to the hidden loneliness.
Yeah. So it's an alienating form of technology in which we can forget that we're physical, right? So it uses our eyes, our necks, our backs, right? But we can forget that we're physical bodies, right? And that we are participating in God's incarnational world, in which God gets a lot of work done through the bodies that are in it.
I was just thinking about this idea of, you know, embodiment being enfleshed,
mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering how much technology does to give us just a distaste for flesh or for being embodied.
Yeah.
Because all of the pictures that we see, we all know intellectually that all of the images that we see in film and in our magazines of people, that they're touched up and doctored and a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
but that's but it takes a long time to get there. So I see all of those images of how I should look.
Yeah.
And they, but it never is going to happen. So when I see actual people, it's sort of a disappointment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like in three dimensions. You never see all of that on the screen. And it's so much more appealing to my eyes. So that there's always this sort of, you know, when you see actual bodies. And I don't know how to describe that. I just, I'm wondering, you know, if it gives us a sense of huge dissatisfaction with ourselves and our own bodies in ways that we're not comfortable in our skins.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you talking about vicarious living?
Not so much vicarious living, but it's just like seeing these images in terms of projected, what should I idea, you know, it's like wanting to be your avatar, you know, and it's kind of like the avatar that's 115 pounds and has no wrinkles and that avatar who's got perfect skin, you know, you sort of, and so you look at yourself in the mirror and you see others around you, and it's just, they don't seem real. Because the really real is good, you know? So it's kind of changing, shifts your idea of what a real person should be.
And not just like physically, but even like emotionally, spiritually, like on social media sites, you can project a person that's not really you.
Right.
Like I have a couple of friends that are on like dating websites, and so like these people, you know, you project to each other, and then they actually meet in real life, and it's not just even the physical, but like, wow, you're boring. You know, like, but on OkCupid, you were really fun. It was really fun to read your profile, but in real life, yeah.
That's right. Like on Facebook, I don't know. To me, it's a real relief to see the real people. What they say.
Yeah.
It's a relief. Oh, these people are real. That's what me. Can relax and we can.
But isn't that an opportunity for Christians then? I mean, if you're really saying this is a tool to facilitate things, then the church is what you project. I mean, not just on dating sites, but it's in terms of using it as a tool to really connect with people. So I use it in my business because I raise money and I set up one-on-one appointments, like 200 a year.
Yeah.
There's no way I could do that without this tool.
That's right.
But you can still have a real connection with people for an hour or two. That's really, so you know, and that you can project one's Christianity or one of other facets of who you are that you can't do.
For sure.
You know. And people grasp onto that. It's a huge opportunity. I grasp onto it because, like, oh my gosh, you're so transparent. Yeah.
This brings up so many different things, and I know Jane was trying to jump in too, but no, it's fine. Really quickly, one of my colleagues is working on Facebook and political action, and so he studied a lot of what Mark Zuckerberg has said about Facebook, and he wants people to be totally transparent. The same person that you are to everybody in every situation, right? So that's the idea of Facebook. No private self, all public self, your family, your friends, your work, everything, right? And so he's studying its impact on political action and to what extent it facilitates or doesn't facilitate, right? The other thing you brought up is choice. This is key. Why? Addicts don't have choice. They're deprived of choice because they're given over in advance or signed over in advance to something. This is why I say my father is addicted, because he cannot, if his iPhone makes a noise, leave it in his pocket. He never turns it off. I had a student on the first day of class, I say it in every class, turn off your cell phones, etc., and commit to this space, did not know how to turn off her phone, right? These are people who have been deprived of choice, right? And they're no longer able to distinguish life-giving uses of it and life-draining uses of it. Right? Jane.
Yeah, this was on the thing before about like projecting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like you see a lot of like cruelty on Facebook and like on social websites because people think they can get away with it.
Yeah.
And because they are really a person. It's like it's soulless basically. Because like one of my like guy classmates did this to me once. Like he said something really mean, and I was like, "Wow, you could not say that to my face." Because you know, I would react in time,
yeah,
where like people would notice and stop him. stops people on Facebook.
That's right.
You can block them, but that, then they'll keep doing it to other people.
And the virtual world is not some alternate reality where it has no bearing on the physical world, right? There are consequences back and forth between the virtual world and the physical world. So I think as Christians, it is our responsibility to be bicultural and biworldly in some, to some extent, so that there can be more of a presence of Christ in our social media and various other places. Let's get into Augustine, because I think you're going to be surprised by how much he had figured out about the human condition in the 5th century. And I'm sorry, we made, you know, a few copies, and we didn't know how much people would be up for on the 4th of July, and it's awesome that you're up for this. He wrote this book called The Confessions. It's a spiritual autobiography, and many people count it the first autobiography in the West. And book 10 is a really critical book for understanding human existence. There are some copies of St. Augustine's Confessions in the bookstore. So tomorrow, if you, you know, want to buy it, you certainly may. But book 10 is a meditation, an extended meditation that begins with Romans 7:15. And that is, I do not understand my own actions. For the good that I would do, I cannot do. And that which I would not do, I do. Right? And so the way it comes to Augustine is, I have become a question to myself. I don't get myself. So he walks through different aspects of not getting himself and questioning himself and trying to find, again, God. Right? He knows God has never left him and that God is looking for him, but he feels very much like he's left God or that he can't find God. So the concupiscence of the eyes is one of the major temptations. And let's read through some of paragraph 54 here. One of you over here, want to read it? David or Boyd?
No, you could.
David, would you please?
There's still another temptation, one more fraught with danger. In addition to the concupiscence of the flesh, which lures us to indulge in the pleasures of all the senses and brings disaster on its slaves who flee far from you, there is also concupiscence of the mind, a frivolous, avid curiosity. Though it works through these same senses, it is a craving not for gratification of the flesh, but for experience through the flesh. It masquerades as a zeal for knowledge and learning. Since it is rooted in a thirst for firsthand information about everything, and since the eyes are paramount among the senses in acquiring information, this inquisitive tendency is called in Holy Scripture concupiscence of the eye. Sight is, properly speaking, the eye's business, but we use the word also for our other senses and their cognitive function. Thus, we do not say, listen for anything red, or smell how shiny, or taste how brilliant this is, or feel the brightness of that. For all such objects, we speak of seeing. Yet we do say not only see how it shines, which the eyes alone can report, we also say, let's see how this sounds, see how fragrant, see what this tastes like, just look how hard that is. So, as I have pointed out, general sense experience is called lust of the eyes because when the other senses explore an object in an effort to collect knowledge, they claim for themselves, by a certain analogy, the office of seeing, in which the eyes unquestionably hold the primacy.
Thank you so much, David. Anything jump out in that passage?
It sounds very contemporary.
Which parts of it sound contemporary? Anybody?
The way he describes the acquisition of information. Anybody else? It just sounds very contemporary. He could have written this last week.
I just had this experience at work. There's a couple blind people, and as I'm talking to them, I realize I'm saying, look at how this works, or let's see this, and I go, oh my goodness. And I was just so brought up short that I was doing that. They didn't seem to be bothered by it in the least. I'm sure that they're used to that, but I was shocked once I had that firsthand experience.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts? What resonated in this passage for you?
The phrase rooted in a thirst for firsthand information about everything, which I've
extended what we think of as firsthand information. So it's no longer the eyewitness on the scene,
mm-hmm.
right? It could be the first one to post.
Mm-hmm.
Could
yeah.
be counted as firsthand knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So while we're on that point, Mary, let's flip over to reflections. And maybe, Mary, if you would, read that final peace point on the right side, a final point.
There is a tremendous need for news curation, people and tools to make sense of the 24/7 influx of information. Contributing to the glut problem is that among the messages, even from trusted reporters and sources, there is always dreck in the mix. Breaking news folded in together with tweeted asides about where to meet for lunch. How to sort through it all in a digestible way and have the way be part of a social network will be an increasingly greater challenge and opportunity.
Thank you for that. Right? And it is really difficult to distinguish, and the understanding of authorship has changed as well with posting things on the web. So you don't always know where a source has originated. And that makes a really big difference, not only for students in the classroom who are trying to quote things, but for voters who are trying to put together information, right? Or for Christians who are trying to be up to date on what's happening in the world, or indeed for folks trying to find out about their neighbors, right? So this is kind of uncharted territory for us. We don't quite know what to do yet with the new opportunities that these personal electronic technologies have made available. What else about this? I was astounded again in reading Augustine that it must not just be in English that we use C for everything, right? Because he was writing in Latin, right? And this is why he's so clever about the human condition. And I think it's similar in German, isn't it? Sicht is used for a lot of things as well, beyond your actual ability to look. And what other language facilities do we have in here? Where C is used as a metaphor, but we take it for granted, right? Until we're talking to a blind person. I've had a similar experience, right? So look and taste this, right? See how lovely this is. Look how hard it is. Those kinds of things.
See what I mean?
See what I mean? You see it, right? Now, so have I convinced you that there's a possibility of addiction with this kind of technology? So Augustine actually helps us understand how this is so. How this is so is because love really is a verb for Augustine. Love puts the lover, the loving one, into a direction and a movement toward that which the lover loves, right? For Augustine, it's pretty stark, and we may not agree with him on every point, but I think it really helps in terms of trying to understand how this addiction actually happens in the first place and what we might do about it, right? So for Augustine, you can either have your love turned toward God or not, right? And he has two loves that are not, love of the world and love of self. And in his writing, almost all love of the world is some kind of twisted love of the self anyway, because you're trying to gratify your flesh or your eyes or anything, right? And this is where we get that curved in on oneself, right? For Augustine, you're either turned toward God or you're turned toward the world or self. So if you can think about maybe just the amount of time that you spend engaging these technologies and what mindset you're in or what sort of preparation you do to get into them or what sort of cool down you get into them, where are you directing your love when you engage such technologies, right?
Yeah. I was just thinking one of the words that Augustine uses that I put together before this is he uses the word restless to
yeah.
describe himself a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like my restlessness, and I never kind of understood it, but I think that that's the kind of restlessness that we have, sort of looking, watching, you know, wanting something but not quite sure what it is that we want.
Exactly.
And hoping to find it maybe through these visual means.
Exactly, yeah. My soul is restless until it rests in thee. Yeah. And these technologies really enable our restlessness. You can feel restless without them, right? You can sit on a rock in a very beautiful location and feel restless within yourself, right? And be turned in on yourself. But they sure do, these technologies sure do help us be restless, right? And they do, just as they release dopamine, they do also increase anxiety, right? They increase anxiety, they change the shape of the hippocampus and other parts of the brain, making it good at some activities and bad at others, right? And in case you're a skeptic about neurobiology or physiology, just think of our wisdom in practice makes perfect. It's the same sort of thing that the neurobiologists are describing. When you practice something, you get better and better at it, right? So that you're almost flawless. Well, that's the same thing that happens with the wiring in our brain when we're using the technologies, right? I remember several years ago this piece coming out about how the South Koreans, who started texting before any of us did, called themselves thumb people. Thumb mm-hmm. people because their thumbs were really agile and adept, right? I also had a youth, I shared this yesterday, in one of my youth groups who had carpal tunnel syndrome from video games, right? So you numb or you wound precisely that which you've aimed to amplify. Okay, so what about how this addiction happens and love being a direction, a movement, a verb? Is that productive for anybody? Does that help anybody understand addiction and how we might turn our attentions and our loves differently?
I mean, I've heard it all over the place among addicts and alcoholics that, like, addicts are the most selfish people ever. And I see that when you talk about, like, where am I moving with this technology? I was thinking about how sometimes I'll send a text to someone and it might seem like it's me reaching out to them and loving, but really I just want to feel that vibration of my phone when they text me back. And if it doesn't come, I feel that anxiety and like that loneliness. Or even on Facebook, like I post a picture or make a status so that I can see how many likes it gets.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not about other people, it's about me.
What do folks think? How much does this have to do with self-esteem and lack of security, or a feeling of insecurity?
I think their self-esteem is in terms of being a source of information. And they look at my Facebook and there's nothing there. I'm only on there because I want to be able to communicate with some people that I have to use to get through. So it just means to have to make.
Yeah, and I have, thank you for saying that. I've talked with a couple of folks doing nonprofit work who start Facebook pages. And their friends have had to say to them gently, you know, I've liked you on Facebook because I want to support you, but please don't send out 12 messages a day. You're filling up my box, and that's going to make me really not like you, right? So I appreciate you're trying to use this technology, but don't blow it for yourself, right? Could limit. Other folks?
Well, I have a Facebook account, but I only have about 6 friends because I do am using it just to see photos of other people, but every once in a while it'll just strike me that so many of the comments are about the person writing them, and then 48 people will say, oh, that's so wonderful, oh, you're so great, oh, everybody must love you, and I just think, oh, gag me with this. I mean, if I was talking to that person, that wouldn't be the only comment. There'd be more to it than 3 words.
Right.
So it just seems shallow and a lot of times self-esteem issues.
And it just seems very dependent. You're just depending on the other people for your esteem, not yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yourself.
Yeah, and even perhaps I'll use the word insidious again in that it's lying in wait. Another thing Nicholas Carr talks about is that the dependence is actually being transferred to the technology itself. So that we have, as part of being human, a sense that we're human with others. We don't live in a world of one. And we have ways to pick up on others' cues and check in on their health and actually bond with them in some way. and that these technologies allow us to transfer all of those sensitivities to our machines. So researchers have done experiments in which they give simple directions to a computer of the responses it should give to somebody, and then they listen in on the conversation and try to make comments about it. And in these conversations, folks end up engaging the computer as a real person and pouring out deep life stories just based on really simple, I'm listening to you kinds of phrases. And that's a way in which we really do rewire our brain, transferring our social antenna from people to machines. So the dependence isn't even on the people saying, oh, you're wonderful. It's how many times the computer shows us you're wonderful.
That's really sad.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
No physical person, nobody with flesh and blood, that this first person feels comfortable pouring their heart out to.
So this is why it matters, and not so we can pity people, but so we can remember that God comes to us in incarnational form through Jesus, and that St. Teresa of Avila wrote a poem, not in English, but the English is beautiful. Christ has now no feet on earth but yours, no hands with which to touch people in need but yours, no eyes through which to look with compassion on the world but yours. So the trick with all of this is that if one of the issues with personal electronic technology is tying up the work of our eyes and depriving us of the rest of our physicality, our other identity, our other culture, reminds us of an incarnational God, right? Who reaches out to people in multiple ways and who can help us balance and enculturate the gospel to a culture that desperately needs.
Well, what this all tells me is that people are dying to connect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. I take the bus to work every day. I take 4 buses to get to work.
Wow.
And just to be able to listen to people and just ask a question and you'll get, the floodgates will open. Mm-hmm. If, as long as they're not connected to an iPhone or an iPad.
But we call it plugged in our house. Because, and part of it, we'll get into this a little bit tomorrow when we talk about spiritual practices, is that naming things really matters. And I find the word connect to be a very robust word that's relevant in our technology and can also be really productive in our spiritual lives. But I don't want to think of my husband as connected when he's got his earbuds are orange because they have M&Ms on them. So we call him plugged in. He's not connected. He's plugged in, right? It's possible for him to be connected through his devices, but that's something else, right? So in playing with how we name things and trying to be upfront about our realities, that's one of the ways our family is engaging this real possibility and in our spiritual practices. So, and if you were hoping for more hope and more guidance in spiritual practices, we have 5 more minutes if we want to brainstorm about it now, but that's tomorrow. Susan, I think you were trying to jump in, and then we'll come back here and call.
I think how vulnerable we are there again, because these people aren't our friends. I mean, they're not our companions, our close friends, and we're basing that whole self-esteem piece on you know, the not strangers, that's not right, but less than close friends are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the flip side of that also is when you don't get the response back, and you may have felt like you poured your heart out with something on that, mm-hmm. and nobody comes back and says anything. Mm-hmm. You know, what did I? You know, it's almost it's a real let down.
Yeah. And then can you bring yourself to repeat it in prayer?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how soon will you expect an answer from God? Right away. Yes. God likes it. He doesn't like it. Paul is trying to get it. Yeah, we have a few.
Well, I think the Augustinian idea about love
distinguish between desire for someone or something and desire for desire. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that gets closer to this addiction idea. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, it may be that alcohol is a way to desire pleasure or something pleasant or pain relief on some level. But increasingly the desire becomes less for that and for the alcohol itself or for the desire of plugged in that the stimulation though.
And even I have a student who's in recovery who's been very open about his recovery, and he says, you know, when I was an addict, I pretty much knew how things were gonna go. I knew how my night would go when I used. Life is so much more surprising, and I can't always handle it, right? I think sometimes that, getting back to the Jumbotron, that sometimes is the Jumbotron. I know roughly what to expect when I have a screen. What's out there is so much more surprising, you know, and could flood in on me in other ways. And Rick, yeah.
If you move from seeing to hearing, what difference does it make? Mm-hmm. What we're finding with cubicles is often I'll define my space by putting on earphones because I'm just so close to people, and I've got to create an identity or a space where I feel comfortable. And I can't do that in a cube. I've got work picks for all these people, or maybe I'm on the bus or someplace else. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like more and more we're defining our space, maybe a little bit of a comfort zone, by just putting on earphones, and then I can be really close to people I really don't want to be. Maybe to say a more positive way, what's the positive of the auditory versus the visual? Because I think it's a fascinating thing that Augustine brings up.
Yeah.
And does that change when many of us try to create space through the ears rather than through the eyes? Mm-hmm.
And it could be that some of those folks who are doing that in cubicles, or some of our friends, our brothers and sisters who are blind, could let us in on that, right? What happens when you work on your other senses? To close, I'm going to read a rewrite, and we can certainly continue conversation past this, but I want to be faithful to our time. We covenanted for an hour, so my Methodist self is going to end us on time. But I'm going to read a rewrite of Psalm 139, which is, "O Lord, you have searched me and known me," right? But this is from Adam Thomas, who wrote a book called Digital Disciple. Okay, so here it is. Gracious God, your presence abounds in every corner of your creation. As I wander the paths of the ever-changing and expanding virtual part of that creation, I pray. When I am distracted by the new, the fast, and the shiny, give me eyes to see your presence, Lord. When I allow the tech to limit my senses, give me eyes to see your presence, Lord. When I fail to remember that you are everywhere, give me eyes to see your presence, Lord. When someone reaches out to me, help me deepen our connection, Lord. When I desire my version of other people over the people they actually are, help me deepen our connection, Lord. When I go no further than fleeting and transient interactions with other people, help me deepen our connection, Lord. When I allow the virtual world to shrink my life to the two dimensions of the computer screen, help me resist isolation, Lord. When I ignore the world around me in favor of the virtual one that I can control, help me resist isolation, Lord. When other people invite me to be part of their community, help me resist isolation, Lord. When I feel that I have no time at all, slow me down, Lord. When the demands of an immediate world squeeze out everything else, slow me down, Lord. When I fail to give you space to work in my life, slow me down, Lord. Grant me the patience to seek you, the grace to find you, and the courage to bring you to all I meet in both this world and in the virtual ones. All this I pray in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. Go in peace.